Okay.
Yeah, well, we were talking about.
I should say first that it's April 9th, 2013, and this is John Tortorici. I'm on the campus of UCLA to interview Professor David Warren Sabian, Mossy Doctoral. Okay.
Okay.
We can start.
But we're talking about his style of writing and the unreplicability and so forth. There's two things. When I was in Germany, at the Max Planck Institute for History, about 1971-72, there was an intellectual historian who worked on the Enlightenment, and he said that he had heard a great deal about Mossy and time to read him, and so he read him and was very disappointed. Mm-hmm. I was curious about that because I was disappointed that he was disappointed. Mm-hmm. But the point is that it was a whole style that this guy couldn't recognize. It wasn't Germanic. It wasn't. It was clear. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he was used to reading intellectual history that was straightforward and clear. Mm-hmm. at a certain point.
Well, that'll be one of my questions. Mossy's reception in Germany, or lack thereof.
Time I was there, he didn't have much of a reception.
Yes.
And when I first went as a graduate student, he had some contacts, which I didn't take up because I was in Tübingen, and the contacts he gave me were in Berlin and so forth. But it was interesting that I was at the International Historical Congress with George, and we had dinner, some graduate students and myself and George and Elton from England.
Mm-hmm.
And Elton was kind of patronizing George the whole time. But the George is unpatronizable.
He was.
Yes. And so forth. Then we bumped into one of the Mommsen brothers. I think it was Hans. Although I don't now remember because they were twins. And I didn't know who they were. And again, that sort of German patronizing was clearly visible and so forth. So I don't think George's way of writing and the stuff that he wrote was something that Germans could appropriate early. And when the first major study, the Roots of the Nazi Mind book,
mm-hmm. Crisis of German Ideology,
mm-hmm. Came out, I don't think they really would have known what to do with it. Mm-hmm. And it's only subsequent, and I'm not sure which books first were widely read in Germany. I know he went to the Kulturwissenschaftliches Institut, I believe, in Essen for a while. And I've known friends who were there at the time and have reminisced about him and so forth. But so that must have been in the mid to late 80s when he went mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. His real contacts in Europe for a long time were in England, mm-hmm. not in Germany. Mm-hmm. And they were with the Jewish emigres, mm-hmm. like Karsten and mm-hmm. And so forth. And he was very popular among them. And mm-hmm.
Well, there was a frustration with George's work on the part of this generation of historians, obviously,
right.
because he was so creative and pioneering. Right. And there's also, I think, great resistance to cultural history in general, the kind of cultural history that George did.
I think so.
But I think it really was the nationalization of the masses that caught the attention. of the Germans, because I think they could put their teeth into that. It gave, you know,
that's probably right. I really never have talked with many Germans about George's work. Yeah. And the people I worked with were doing quite different kinds of social history.
Yes.
And first were very strongly influenced by Habermas, then by Bourdieu. Mm-hmm. And so forth. And I got involved with putting together an anthropology and history group at in Göttingen. Mm-hmm. And so our directions went off in completely differently. And so mm-hmm. none of the people I knew were really interested in that period and in the stuff that George did. And mm-hmm. By the time I got there, it was all internalized. Mm-hmm. And then I would say the people that should have been interested were the Bielefeld School, but they were heavily into sociological history.
Social history and... Yes.
But sociological history.
Social, okay.
Not even social history. Really? I mean, it's... The term they used was Gesellschaftsgeschichte rather than Sozialgeschichte, mm-hmm. although they would use the word Sozialgeschichte, but they were heavily influenced by Weber, heavily influenced by modernization theory at the time, and all of that, you know, George would have kind of brushed off with a gesture. And my own approach to social history was really also quite different. So while I became very good friends with Jürgen Kocka, and Kocka eventually also got to know George quite well,
yes.
And mm-hmm. and appreciated mm-hmm. George a lot. But that's all yeah. later, and it's also, by that time I was back in the States mostly, mm-hmm. so I really don't know much about his reception.
Okay.
I just know that it began to happen much later than I would have wished, because at the time when I was intensely involved and intensely there, people weren't, people around me weren't very interested. Mm-hmm. Now, I suspect that, now I don't know this, but I suspect that as people began to pull away from the Bielefeld School, that then there was an opening for cultural history. Mm-hmm. I know he was very close to, or pretty good friends with Nipperdine.
Yes, right.
And Nipperdine was sort of a pull to the Bielefeld School. And he came to the Princeton Institute, came back bug-eyed over Goethean anthropology, and pursued a kind of history that was more cultural history, and therefore perhaps it's through people like Nipperdine that was a greater opening for George. Mm,
yes.
But not with a dominant school in the late 60s, early 70s was the Bielefeld School. That mm-hmm. was the hot thing, and mm-hmm. and I don't see how they could easily have appropriated George. Now, later on, people like Weber began to talk about cultural history, mm-hmm. and it could be at that point, but, you know, none of these people were going to give George a close read because mm. they were so busy promulgating whatever it is they were promulgating. Mm-hmm. But,
well, and cultural history had a lot of baggage.
Right. Absolutely.
So
no, that's quite right, and yes. I remember I was at a it was kind of a low point in my career. I was at the at the German Historiker Tag. I think it was in Berlin, and there was a panel mm-hmm. with Wehler and Kocka and Wolfgang Mommsen and Lutz Niethammer. Lutz Niethammer would have been more open to George, much more open to George. And in fact, he was the director of the Kulturwissenschaftliches Institut when George was there. Mm. An intellectual of a completely different kind from the Bielefeld people. And So I was on this panel, and Veda brushed off the kind of thing that I was interested in, which was the history of everyday life and anthropology and history, as his term would have been fascistoid. His critique was of people like Alf Lutke, who was in the Institute with me, and who was developing theoretical understandings of Alltagsgeschichte, or everyday life. And for Wehler, for him it was a recurrence of populist, Völkisch, I don't know what he thought, but he just didn't like it at all. And so there was I gave a kind of introduction to ways of thinking, but my German was too slow, and then Veda was very funny. And so there was a big, there was about 1,000 people there, or 800. It was a confrontation of two very different kinds of history, and I outlined a kind of actually a critique of Kocka, but unfortunately I misunderstood, and Kocka was the chair of the session, so he couldn't really answer me directly and
respond
and so forth. But I made a plaidoyer for a kind of anthropology and history approach to society, and Veda was having none of it. And,
what year was that?
I'd have to look at with the historical talk in I think I was already gone, so it would have to be after 73.
Okay.
And I would have been here, so about 74, 75, 76, okay, somewhere around there, because I flew from here to there.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to follow this script?
Sure, I'll follow your script, and I'll start with where I was born.
Yeah, so let's go back to
I was born
the birth.
I was born in the thicket of. I was born in Waltham, Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
And Waltham probably influenced me a great deal, actually, because came from a family that my parents had immigrated from Nova Scotia. The Sabian family had come to the United States in 1633. Or to colonies, Massachusetts. But in 1763, after the British beat up the French and the French were kicked out, Sabians went up and took their farms. So they were Nova Scotians, and they came back. And my grandfather, on my mother's side, was a Baptist minister. And that sort of set the tone for the family. My father was a dyed-in-the-wool Baptist. The only time he ever got angry with me was when I called into question the doctrine of total immersion with baptism. In any event, it was a fundamentalist family, very much fundamentalist, and my mother had hoped to send three missionaries off into the world. She won with my older brother. He's in Costa Rica as a missionary. Family life was very warm. It was very difficult to rebel in that kind of family.
Because of the emotional warmth sustaining.
And my mother invented all by herself Jewish guilt. When I hear about Jewish mothers, nothing on my mother. And she was very, very clear that I could do what I want, but this is her position, you know, like dancing. You may go dance if you wish, but I think, you know, this is my position, but that's why I didn't dance, to my horror. Today I still can't dance properly. But, you know, there's no smoking, no drinking, no sex, no, I mean, all these different problems. And, but, and we went to church a lot, young people, all kinds of things. So, and I was very sort of then, as a young kid, I was very you know, incipient historian, incipient intellectual, whatever you want to say. So by the time I was 14, I was reading Calvin's Institutes. I was, and then very interesting, my family, my mother's family, had obviously had long winter nights with no electricity and you know, kind of kerosene lamp. And they had developed a style of declaiming poetry, memorizing masses of poetry. And so that kind of got ingrained in me. So I memorized a lot of poetry. But I also thought that you kind of memorize texts. So we had to memorize masses of the Bible so forth. So when I first read... When I was about 14, I was reading Calvin's Institutes. I started reading Plato. And so I started with the Phaedo, which is relatively short, and I memorized it. Wow. Then I realized as the dialogues got longer and longer, you can't do this and so forth. So I gave up on that approach to intellectual life. But in any event, what was really interesting is Waltham was a place of... A stable, slightly older immigrant groups. And I became extraordinarily aware of how the city functioned. The politics were completely controlled by the Irish. The new money and very wealthy, the only millionaires, I think there were 7 millionaires in Waltham at that time, and they were all Italian. They had made their money in market gardening and in construction. And they had well, I'll talk about that in a minute. And then there were the Jewish two kinds, ones who had businesses in Waltham, and I worked in a drugstore for one of them, and the intellectuals that were tied up with the big institutions, the psychiatric institutions, and so forth. Now these things have collapsed and have disappeared, but at the time they were, you know, they were cities with huge buildings and masses of people in them. And the doctor's kids were in high school with me, and in fact, one of them, Louis Azakov, was, you know, we spent hours cruising in my junior and senior year once I could drive. Friday nights talking about everything. And I've reconnected with Louis, who's become a prize-winning poet. I flew off to hear him read his poetry in Waltham last October. And someone like he is a genuine intellectual from the very beginning, very moral, very concerned. And so it was a very sympathetic kind of relationship. And then the other group in Waltham were immigrants from Canada, French Canadians. I think that's the roughly... the milieu. So and then I worked, I can remember working in a haberdashery and one Christmas, and one of the girls from my school came in, an Italian girl, and she bought 15 sweaters. I can't remember the brand, but they're very expensive. 15 for first cousins or cousins. And the idea of an extended kinship group on the one hand. Second, a teenage girl with that kind of money obviously, you brought to go out and buy from your cousins, but nonetheless, was an eye opener. And so I began to pay very close attention to the fact that you had three Catholic groups who didn't intermingle, whose churches were all Irish, Italian, French Canadian, miscellaneous whites of various kinds, Episcopalians, Baptists, whatever. And when I say miscellaneous whites, there's a sense of, I mean, WASP would be the better term. And so looking at this, the power in, you know, the political power on the one hand, the new money, and then there were two or three old estates in Waltham, very old money. You never knew these people. And the rumor was that their money had been made in the illegal slave trade.
Mm-hmm.
But we're talking about 100-year-old families, but you never met them. You just knew that they kind of existed in the periphery. So it was a very interesting thing. And so my early background was one of thinking and struggling with ideas about Protestant, and there George was very important as well later. So it's Protestantism and
kinship so early,
and looking amazing. At kinship and looking at the way, but also kind of looking at social class and social groups. I remember you know, my mother let me dress as I wanted to, and I would buy flashy yellow jackets and things like that. And there was this teacher in the, I think, fourth or fifth grade who clearly differentiated among her students by class.
Mm-hmm.
And so the kids who their mothers dressed and were properly dressed and had the right, you know, who bought all the stuff from Harvard Square, I mean, I began to understand all that. She liked them and gave them preference. Me, I was kind of in my yellow jackets or whatever I was, and my loud mouth and so forth.
It's amazing how these things are very early recognized by students, and yet they're never acknowledged.
So my sense of class, my sense of social differentiation, ethnicity, the importance of religion in maintaining. I learned later that the Baptist church we went to, because somebody did a book on it, called Working Men of Waltham or something like that, and the church I went to was the Working Men's Church, and I didn't realize that. So what was really there were a lot of people who came down from the Maritimes or what have you, and were working at the Waltham Watch Company, which was very close by. And so they sort of centered around this church, and I probably got a strong sense of that as well. But I you know, it's all, you know, thinking about it later. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so so that was the milieu and the structure and so forth. Now, I had two brothers, older brother, 3 years older. Obviously, I was in conflict with him. Mm-hmm. And he was the one who, followed my mother, who was the dominant figure in the family.
And he is
and
now...
And he's now the missionary.
Okay, right. And he's still...
Yes.
Mission.
Very much a missionary. And although I have to say that I, with all my later on differentiation and so forth, but I he's the one who now pushes family relations. Mm-hmm. We spent 3 days with him just now, and he's actually quite impressive. Was very much interested in teenagers and so forth, and we had spent summers at a summer camp in New Hampshire, a Christian summer camp. And he rose up to be director of that eventually. And that plays a big role in his ultimate trajectory. Was he's very interested in developing institutions for bringing teenagers together and so forth that are tied to small group interaction. He stresses relationships, criticizes camping in the United States as more entertainment camping and so forth. And so, and he's written a lot of manuals, and he actually taught at one of the universities in San Jose. He taught camping, and he was asked to found a department of recreation, which he eventually didn't do. But so he's been very involved in Costa Rica, and also he's very ecumenical. Some of his closest friends are Catholic, and when I grew up, Catholic Protestant was a very strong
thing. Yes.
So coming away, I'm more impressed with him than I would have acknowledged as a kid. But anyway, that played a big role, I think, the second kid in pushing against the older brother. Then a younger brother who's 11 months younger, who essentially kind of followed in my footsteps. I get a PhD and so forth, ended up in Canada. Very active in developing cultural institutions outside of in Ottawa. He just got a big medal from Ottawa for his cultural activities and so forth. But so there was a family. My father was a grocer, very quiet. And unfortunately, he died when I was about 21, when I was back at Brandeis, and so forth. But I think my mother still was, even when he was alive, the kind of dominant figure in because that was day to day. Teachers, that's quite interesting, because you always have some teachers who encourage you and some teachers who, in a sense, try to push you back. And so I had, you know, I read all the time, and otherwise I was mouthing off, I think, in school. And in the second, third, and maybe fourth grades, that was it. It was second, third, and fourth grades. I had teachers who just left me alone, let me sit in the back of the room and read. And I can remember, I can't remember which grade it was. It was really dumb. We had to do math every day, and, you know, I knew the math. So the paper would come up, and we're supposed to do stuff, and I would pull out a book and have it and read it, but I had to get rid of the paper, so I ate it. and then when the kid came to collect it, I passed it in. And the teacher never either noticed or cared.
Wow. That's amazing.
So I would always read it, and I would sit at the back of the room and read and read and read. And then the fourth grade, I remember the fourth grade teacher very much encouraged me in the reading. And we had a little box of books that came from the library, and she kind of pointed out things for me to read and so forth. And so I just, for a couple hours a day at least, I wasn't paying any attention to what was going in class and just reading. It was a sixth grade teacher who was the real problem. She's the one that I began to see the class differences. Don't even remember her name. She dressed differently. She had a style of a bourgeois style that the others didn't have. Now, remember, you know, my generation is the last great generation, I think, of women teachers. There was nothing else for women to do. They could become nurses or teachers. And so we had brilliant, well-educated women teachers. And with the feminist movement, that all broke down, and they go off into all kinds of other. My suspicion is that that group of extraordinarily well-educated, no other place to go, is part of the collapse of the school system in America. But they were really good, and then when I went to junior high school in the ninth grade, we had a teacher who taught ancient history, who gave us real syllabi, extra reading. She was just a brilliant teacher, and I can't say that any of these teachers really got me going in history, except this woman gave me a vision of what it could be, but.
So the books you were reading were
novels.
Or mostly novels.
Yeah, but a lot of historical novels.
Right.
And it turns out one of my colleagues here, who's now retired, Peter Ryle, I walked into his office one day, and arrayed there were all of the novels he was reading as a teenager. And Kenneth, what's his name, did all these... Kenneth Roberts did these great New England colonial novels and Revolutionary War novels.
Right. Yes.
And of course the Leatherstocking Tales and so forth. I think my interest in history was determined by these two trajectories. That is, an understanding of Protestantism, which was historically oriented, reading Calvin. I belonged to a book club that, as a teenager, that was called the Evangelical Book Club or something like that. We got a book a month. And Jonathan Edwards' great book on free will, or the lack of free will, was one of the books, and I got my teeth into that and the debates about free will and so forth. And so there was that sort of interest in intellectual development and life. But the other thing was historical novels. They really perhaps determined my interest in history more than any history teacher. So I wish I could remember the name of this history teacher. She was really brilliant. And she was, you think of these, I mean, she would, nowadays she'd be a university professor, without any question. As many of the teachers I had would now be. anyway, so that was.
Do you remember if she was single or married?
I think she was single.
Yeah.
A lot of them were single.
Yes.
Yeah, a lot of them were single. Oh, yes.
My teachers were too.
The Latin teacher was, I mean, we hated our Latin teacher, but she was really good. And it's very interesting. I keep relearning my Latin in order to read certain 17th century texts. But since I don't do it on a regular basis, it fades and I have to relearn it. And so I bought this grammar, which turned out to be the grammar we had in the ninth grade, and I started going through, and it all came back. It's all there, except certain chapters, and clearly those were the chapters I was lazy and didn't really work at, and then these others I worked at, and so forth. So it's all exactly what I could remember, and exactly what was there had to do with this this quite remarkable Latin teacher.
I'm going to pause.
Undergraduate work. My older brother had gone to a college called Houghton College, which is 70 miles south of Buffalo and Rochester, sort of in the triangle. And so I followed suit. And it was a Wesleyan Methodist college. Where its strength lay was in close reading of texts. It was very biblically oriented, but was a great teacher in soft lit. We went through absolutely. Her name was Rickard, I think. she's called Doc Jo, Josephine, I think her name was Rickard. And she was, a Victorian. She loved Victorian prose. I took a course from her later on, precisely on Victorian prose. But, you know, she had it all memorized. And we had to memorize the prologue to the Canterbury Tales, you know, and do it in Old English. Van that a prelude with the shorter socht of the drocht of Bartlett, you know, and so forth. And she would just sort of stand back, close her eyes, and so forth. Now, the limitation was absolutely no secondary literature. So you never were introduced to literary criticism at all. You read the texts. And the same thing, we had to take Bible courses. They weren't all that exciting. They weren't all that good. But they were all textual-based. And I would say that was the perhaps strongest influence. There was the historian who was there, the older historian, was terrible. And she certainly didn't influence me to go into history. But then there was a young guy came named Troutman, who taught American history and did some political theory and so forth. And he was kind of influential. He was a very nice man. We got kind of close. And he encouraged me. I wouldn't say he was a very strong intellectual influence on me, although quite interesting, he was one of the first people ever to do a dissertation. He did at Kentucky that used statistics. I don't think he published his dissertation. He eventually went off to like Western Kentucky and became chair of the department or something like that. But so it was a moment of at least encouragement. Mm-hmm. But the things that I remember, the great stuff that I remember, I took some Latin, I took a French course and so forth. But the influence was in literature and texts, but not literary criticism and not
history.
And not history, essentially, and philosophy. So again, the philosophy I took was mostly the history of philosophy. So when I showed up, my brother said, "Tell the philosophy professor," which he knew well, "that you don't want to take the introduction of philosophy. You want to jump right into the advanced course," and he let me do it. So. Right. So we're reading again from Plato to Haeckel or where you know, so my approach to philosophy wasn't analytical or systematic; it was historical, and it was like the history of ideas. So that perhaps gave me a stronger sense of the possibilities in intellectual history than any history I took. The woman who taught history was a real disaster.
So you got your undergraduate degree here?
At Houghton,
okay.
And I did it in 3 years. I was already bored, so I went to summer school at Boston University. Mm-hmm. Oh, there I took some history. In fact, I did take some history at Boston University, and there the history was much more exciting, much more interesting. They were usually, the summer schools were usually taught by, I think probably now, either fresh PhDs or what have you. They weren't on the regular faculty, I don't think, but they were very exciting. And for the first time, very systematic, and I could come away quite excited by some of them, and sort of took some economics there, and that one course of economics is all economics I know, but it also helped determine ways in which I could conceptualize things.
So you graduated in undergraduate
at 60
in 1960. Okay,
yeah,
and then you got your master's at
Wisconsin
Oh, you did? Yeah. So you came
so,
right
So I came right directly to Wisconsin. Now, I applied to various places. Yeah. Got into... the only place that gave me any money was Wisconsin, where they were giving everybody these tuition, out-of-state tuition waivers, mm-hmm. or whatever they were.
And the tuition was,
yeah, the
was
tuition
very
wasn't
modest
very,
in
yeah,
those
very modest.
Years.
And I could take a little loan out and so forth. So I went... And the first year, I'd never heard of George, and I never, okay. you know, and the only thing I knew is that Wisconsin was the leftist university, which was a kind of made me nervous. That was the other thing I like, transition from being a Republican to being some kind of more radical, and in this period of leaving Houghton. Transitioned away from any belief, and I suppose George might play in a sense play a role, but only passively in the sense that it was great intellectual history, and I was thinking through all kinds of ways of thinking about mm-hmm. history. But George had me pegged as George had this seminar full of every kind of. You know, he had two kinds of Catholics. He had a Trotskyist and a Trotskyite, and so forth and so
on. Do you
on.
Think he and selected them that way? Or?
No, but once he had you pegged, he kind of pegged you that way. Kept
yes.
pushing you that way. So
and then he
Lutheran.
Would ask you specific.
Yeah, so
kind of needle.
He had
yeah.
me. He had me pegged as the. The WASP, the but the real Protestant and so forth, and he kept pushing me to be the thing. No.
Challenging
no.
you, yes.
But
because of course that was very seductive to him.
Well, yeah, I know actually.
It really was.
So anyway, yeah. so I came to I came there and like there was 150 of us new. I mean,
really?
Wisconsin was
wow.
a factory. There was a huge... Yeah. I think there were 600 graduate students all together in history at mm-hmm. various levels. And I went in, and the chair of the department at the moment was English historian whose name escapes me at the moment. He did 17th century England. And I went in, and he said, well, what are you interested in? And I said... I've narrowed it down to intellectual history and the early modern period. That was all I could. He said, you go to Mossy. And that's how I got started. Mm-hmm. And I went to see George, and he was sitting in his office with this high forehead. And, mm-hmm. And all of us remarked how over the 20 or 30 years we knew him, he was always the same age. And... And he was kind of a little bit intimidating, and I more than intimidating. And I asked him what his seminar was going to be on, and he said, "I'll tell you when you get there." Mm-hmm. So then, I asked
Amazing.
Him. Around. He told other people it was going to be on Calvinism,
mm-hmm.
of all things. Yeah, Calvin and Calvinism. That was right down my alley, because one of the things that I'd done as an undergraduate in a Wesleyan Methodist thing was use Calvinism as a way of differentiating myself. And so
he probably was testing George. He had this way of testing his potential students.
Well, that's true.
But
it was interesting because I asked other people, and he had told them what it was. So I mm-hmm. and so and Wisconsin was great because this. This huge library, and they had a huge room with journals.
Mm-hmm. They still have.
And the journals were laid out all around in this huge yeah. circle. And once I knew it was going to be on Calvinism, you don't really know what to do and so forth. But I was killing time for a week or so before we started. So I went into that room, and I just... I don't know. Again, you don't know what prompts what you do, but I simply went around that room and picked up every single journal in my hand and looked at it. And in the course of doing so, found 6 or 7 articles about Calvinism in one way, and discovered the journals. Like, there was, they had everything, like the Bulletin of French Huguenot history, and the Archiv für Reformationsgeschichte, and which I couldn't really read because I didn't have German, and at that time I don't think they published in English. But I went around and I jotted down all the journals which seemed relevant, read the 6 or 7 articles that introduced me to the current scholarship. And then we got into the seminar, and it was very intimidating because it was a series of older students and then a bunch of us who were first-year students, and we kind of ranged around the seminar, and the seminar in that time was in the library. About the library rooms, and so George is sitting there with his pipe, and he had another pipe ready, and he had all the paraphernalia. The ashes are dropping all over his shirt and burning holes, and so forth. And in those days, he smoked so much he had no feeling in his cheeks, so you could watch a fly go across his cheek, and he wouldn't notice.
That's amazing.
And he sort of was, he was of course extraordinarily charismatic and very funny, and so he started off, and he started with the older students, and he'd say, "What are you writing your paper on?" Well, first, remember, it's a semester, so the first 3 or 4 weeks we had to read the Calvin's Institutes and write a short paper on some subject like predestination or whatever. And so he got our feet wet, and then he started with talking about the general bibliographical aids and the major works and so forth and so on. But then he started with the older people, and the older people all had these great topics, you know, and some of them were directly within the sort of Calvinism thing. Mm-hmm. Others were Reformation in general or some issue. And he would talk about each one. And there was one guy whose name escapes me, who was George's assistant and was the older one and the one that knew everything. And he eventually left George, did his PhD at Columbia, and then taught at Carleton College, and was... Lynn Hunt's major influence, for example. So that, anyway, but he, I'm trying to think of his name, but he taught for years and years and years at Carleton and was a famous history teacher. But sociologically oriented, he was interested in, at that point, and I think he eventually did it, on the spread of Calvinism in 16th century France and sort of a sociological approach.
We have two of Lynn Hunt's students on our faculty, so this is going to tell them about this.
Yes, so there's a genealogy.
I'll find the name.
Anyway, so as he goes around, then he comes to the new people, and nobody had a clue. So somebody said, "I'm kind of interested in Calvinism and sects," and of course George misunderstood immediately. And his eyebrows raised and so forth, and there was some play on that. And George said, "Well, there's an article on this subject, what's the journal?" And I said, I didn't know how to pronounce it, but Reformationsgeschichte or whatever. He looked at me. And because I had just gone around all the thing that I had all these things.
He noticed you. Yeah.
And then the next kid wanted to do something on Luther and Calvin, blah, 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 and he said, "Well, there's an article in the journal of so-and-so. See, who is it by?" And I said, "By so-and-so." And this went 4 or 5 times. But it was just by chance that I had done this, not knowing how to get started. Mm-hmm. So George's eyebrows kept looking at me, and his eyebrows would rise. And then because I was, and it just had to do with my own biography, I was interested in Calvinism and critiques of Calvinism, that is. So, and I formulated then as Calvinism and skepticism. So he looked at me, I was the last person here, and he said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I was interested in Calvinism and skepticism. He said, is this the first student I've ever had that's come up with a good idea? He said. Wow. I thought, great. And they said, come into my office tomorrow, and I'll give you a bibliography. Well, no. In those days, George typed on this old computer, like, very fast. And I came in, and he said, oh, Calvin and skepticism. And he said, and he types up, like, 7 or 8 titles, and so rips it up, gives it to me, says, go read these. So I go up to the library, and of course, 3 or 4 of them don't exist. and
he just made up
the
title.
And the titles are wrong, and so forth. And pardon me, my introduction to the library was partly trying to figure out what the hell he was talking about. And of course, 2 or 3 of them were completely irrelevant. You know, they had nothing to do with the subject. But he had told us about 2 great. Wisconsin was, the library was full of stuff, and they had bought a Huguenot library that's sitting in the middle of the stacks.
Now in special collections, right. What's left of it, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's the same thing here, ripping off of 17th century texts. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I kind of went into that, and there was another special collection, the Tank Collection, mm-hmm, which was this incredible collection of Dutch Calvinist library, but the trouble is a lot of it was in Latin. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful library, but mm-hmm, I didn't know quite how to start there. But I look at the Huguenot stuff, and since I had French, I ran across this guy Amirault, and it was an attempt to create the particular volume was an attempt to create a rational understanding of the Eucharist. And so I thought, so my master's thesis was on Amirault. Mm-hmm. Okay. And, but the first paper I wrote was about this. And of course, George started with the older students first, and then I was the first of the new students.
Do you recall any of the names of those older students?
Yeah, Bob Soucy.
He was in the... Okay.
Yeah, and Grendler.
Okay, Grendler. Many of them went on to careers.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. Now, the interesting thing is my generation, nobody did. That is, the only one who did was Dan Toft, and Dan Toft then failed to get tenure. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I don't know what happened to him, but he came from a farm family in Iowa with a lot of money. He had inherited a lot of money, he lived. He had eventually 4 children, 3 boys in Germany. We were there at the same time. He was at Heidelberg. I was in Tübingen, and he wasn't really very, I'm going to say, scholarly. He had liked history. He never really properly learned Latin. He hired somebody to read the Latin text for him, and so forth. So he wrote this thesis. He got a nice job at Washington University in St. Louis, but he didn't get tenure, and so forth. So, but none of the others really finished. It was these older, and then the next generation after me. So Bob Soucy wrote very much in the Mossy mold, and looked at these right-wing French people before the war, like Barrès and so forth. Mm-hmm. Grendler was in some ways like me, I mean, he's a Catholic kid, interested in the Renaissance, did a very, became a great scholar in Toronto, but not so much in the George Mossy mold. It moved off in a different direction. Mm-hmm. And when we tried to do the the fest trip, both Susie and Grenler fought like hell and over our vision of what it should look like. And Grenler eventually didn't contribute anything. Right. I can't remember if Susie did or not.
I don't think so.
I don't think so. It was the same. It was the same thing. It was. But if I remember correctly, almost everybody in that Festschrift is of the next generation, the post-65
people. I believe you're right.
So it was a so it was a very exciting moment, very exciting time. Anyway, so I presented my paper, and George started by saying, "I'm going." Or usually, and I still do this with my seminars. He simply pick on somebody and went around the room. So everybody had space to learn how to develop a critique. And I really liked that. And I still do it, because I was always a little hesitant to jump in. And so by having the, that you had to have something ready was very useful, and you learned to formulate. So I still do that with Garrison. But so,
but he was tough in the way that he critiqued front of other people.
Absolutely,
and
I still do the same.
That's great.
Absolutely, I take students very seriously. Mm-hmm. I go through everything from grammar to how they formulate, to how they do footnotes, to how they conceptualize, and I do precisely what George did. He went around, but he had already typed out his points. And then he would take the last 20 or 30 minutes and say, now I'm going to summarize, but he already had it, and I already always already have it, and go through the points systematically and very, very rigorously. So when I gave my paper, he said, we're going to do it differently tonight, because here's a paper a first-year student who makes every mistake that a first-year student makes. And then he proceeded for 2 hours to have the seminar laughing so hard that people were falling off their chairs.
About you?
About me. It was
extraordinarily humiliating.
Well, both humiliating, but I mean, even I was laughing so hard at his critique. His critique was just devastating. And
but he gave you
full attention. So as I walked out.
Yeah,
I said to this guy who ended up in Carleton, I said, I guess I better quit. And he said, what? And I said, well, look what he did. He said he would never have done that if he didn't think highly of it. So that, you know, but George never, ever told a student he was good or bad. So if a student gave an awful paper or blew him off, he would start the seminar by just changing the subject and never discuss the student's paper. He did that 2 or 3 times in the time I was there. And
he would completely ignore.
He would ignore the student, essentially.
Write them off.
Yes. And
you couldn't do that now, but anyways, we won't go into that.
No, and in fact, the worst of it is that I have developed a highly critical style, but I will tell a student right straight that you shouldn't continue. And this creates for the students in the seminar a very devastating moment. But I don't know else how else to do it.
Do you tell them that in front of other people?
And if they really blow me off, you know, and just don't, as several have done over the years, but you can do very poor work, that is, not know how to do it, and screw up. That doesn't bother me. It's if you just don't try or don't even pay attention, and this happens, happens every couple of years to somebody like that.
Yeah.
But like in the seminar I just did, everybody tried. Some of them did a disastrous job, but but I tell them why and how and how they should go about it, and and so forth. So I'm very rigorous, precisely in the way that George was, and I learned that from George, and I take them very seriously. And by the time they get to writing their dissertations, they have a much better idea. But some still can't write. I mean, amazing. It's amazing how poor some people are with writing.
Well, not to digress too much, but the New York Times now is so poorly written that I'm, you know, I feel sometimes I'm learning bad things from reading this paper. That's so bad.
That's absolutely right. And all kinds of ways of that are oral ways of thinking have crept in.
Yes.
In which, like, the definite article is missing or what have you. But I have these students who really, their sentences make no sense and so forth, and even at the PhD level. And I put a lot of time into even basic grammar and instruction, which George would never have done, he would thoroughly critique how you formulated something and so forth. So this was.
Did the students, were some of the students just devastated and left the seminar?
Well, and he blew off women as fast as he could blow them off, and it was pretty much a male bund. Later on, he changed his whole way of doing it.
But although he had that that one student that he thought was one of his best, Margaret,
and he always talked about Margaret. Margaret was a great exception. It was a great exception, but she was a nun.
Was she? I didn't know.
And I think she had stopped being a nun, but she had been a nun. And so George, I think, was scared of her.
The other women were fascinated by her.
And then he was so disappointed because she went to take care of her mother instead of going to Harvard.
Right. Yeah. He had gotten her a job, and she decided to...
To take care of her mother.
Yes. And ended up at Whitewater, I think.
Yeah. And George always used her as a great example of a great mind. All knew about Margaret and so forth. But there were several women showed up in each of his seminars while I was there, and they were pretty quickly gone.
Really.
And they weren't any worse than some of the guys. And I once caught George and some other faculty member who I can't remember in the hall saying I got rid of her. You know, that was a period that then now the woman he idolized while I was there was Joan Scott.
Indeed.
And Joan Scott wasn't in his seminar, but he got her as his teaching assistant and eventually read her dissertation. And you know the story about her making what's-his-face read it.
Harvey Goldberg
read it so forth. Because Harvey...
They remained good friends.
Oh, yeah.
And... I think Joan always had a feeling of, I shouldn't really be this close to George, given, you know, his reputation with some other women, you know.
Well, but that all changed. Yeah, and then George was, I think Nikki Keddie claims, who was my colleague here for a long time and a great Iran scholar. She was up for a job at Wisconsin, and that was in the days when I don't think there was any woman in the department. She claims that she was poorly dealt with and so forth. Now, that has all changed, and nobody can... George became very close with Itzi Hull.
With a whole lot of women.
And very
supportive in the time that I knew him. He was extremely... Yes. And more interested, actually, in their work. than he was in other work.
And he also changed. You see, he was originally, you see, I was in the transition period. He'd come up out of Haverford, which was an all-male school.
Great.
Went to Harvard, which was all-male.
Had gone to all-male boarding school. Had very little...
Hadn't a clue what women
interaction with women.
Yes, right. Except his mother and his stepmother.
His mother, who was
And his stepmother,
hysterical.
Who was in love with it. Went
right. Yeah. And his sister, but that relationship...
And sister and so forth,
But very few women in his life.
Right.
And it was possible to be that way in that generation.
Yes, yes. And then he had this very close relationship with, what's her name in England?
Paula.
In any event, once I never met Roger, I only met Paula, and then I met George there in the house, and that was a close relationship, and George always stayed with them. And so forth.
By the way, when did you and Ruth get married? Were you married before you came to Madison? Or?
No, I came to Madison first. Ruth was still an undergraduate.
Okay.
Then, as soon as she finished. And she was 2 years behind me. She's a year younger.
So she went to Wisconsin also.
No, she went to Houghton.
You met at Houghton.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So she was essentially a year and several months younger than I.
Mm-hmm.
But I went through in 3 years, and she didn't.
Okay.
She also came from a missionary family and was born in Nigeria. And her father was the head of, eventually, of the mission and then head of an interdenominational mission thing.
Mm-hmm.
And and so this anyway, so she was there. I did my master's. Then I went after I did my master's with George, and George encouraged me. So I got it done in 1 year, and nobody else did in those days. But I had gone through in 3 years. I do my master's so quickly. I don't know. I was still torn. I wasn't quite. I didn't quite understand what I was getting at Wisconsin. And so I went to Brandeis, and I wanted to study with Marcuse. So I went to Brandeis.
Did George introduce you to Marcuse? No. This was something that came from the atmosphere.
It came from reading Marcuse's book on Hegel. And I knew they had this history of ideas department, I really thought that... Somehow I was drawn to that.
Was this before Marcuse became this cult figure and had, you know, the...
Well, for me, it was already with the Hegel book. I went to Brandeis. He accepted me. He liked my application. But he was gone that year, writing One Dimensional Man. He was in Europe. I then spent the year in... and realized that here was a, you know, Wisconsin had a really clear program. Brandeis didn't. The only faculty member that I there were two faculty members, but the one that I was very influenced by, extraordinarily influenced by, was Frank Manuel.
Okay.
Now, Frank Manuel was, his entire teaching was explication de texte. You look at a text, you know.
George
was the opposite, you know, was the big, broad, big intellectual, historical thing. And it took me 25 years to deal with that. On the one hand, wanting to look close, and on the other hand, to give broad understandings of things. And so George was my model at one level of teaching, and I certainly adapted his whole model of graduate teaching. And Frank Manuel was the other intellectual model, and I couldn't figure out a synthesis. I went to Brandeis, and Marcuse was gone, and I began to see that when you look at Marcuse, you know, he would teach Aristotle, he would teach Hegel, and so forth, and I thought, how can this person do this? And I began to realize that essentially... what he was a product of the German Gymnasium with Greek and Latin and all of those texts. And then he does Hegel and is tied up with the as a younger member of the Frankfurt School. And so that in a sense, despite the fact that I never really met him, I had this vision of a kind of education that I could never have. I'd already had, and realized that this is the product of the German gymnasium, as in a sense George was and wasn't. That is, George went to these Zalem and mm-hmm. so forth, mm-hmm. And came up out of a milieu which would have been a gymnasium milieu, but ended up in these
English
both English and, mm-hmm. and schools.
Yeah.
So he would have had that partly classical training,
mm-hmm.
but he was also a kid who sat around and read all this crap. And it's that feeling for the second rate but widely read
popular
mm-hmm. stuff, which George developed as a kid,
mm.
which if he'd gone to a real classical gymnasium, he wouldn't have had the time to do.
Mm.
He would have been learning Greek and mm-hmm. Latin and, mm-hmm. and the only way you learn Greek and Latin is have it beaten into you, so he would this was very attractive, but the Frank Manual, we went systematically through Hume and Montesquieu and Wright and Rousseau and so forth, and it was great stuff. So for 1 year, I redid my education, and I took 3 courses each term, each semester, and in some form of History of Ideas,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and I took a seminar on Hegel with a guy named Heinz Lubach, or Harry Lubach, who eventually went and taught in England as well, and was one of the founding members of the Department of History at Essex,
mm-hmm.
And I met him a couple of times. He's a very nice man, but again, we read sentence by sentence, we read the Phenomenology.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great experience, since none of us understood it. And each of us is trying to figure out. He had written this really very interesting stuff on Aristotle and either Hegel or Aristotle and Marx, and might have done both, and so forth. So those were the two people at Brandeis. As I said, I read, I took a course in ancient thought, and so we read a book a week,
mm-hmm.
and then medieval, a book a week,
So at Wisconsin, you didn't have that kind of immersion.
No,
it was. No. I see. There weren't other professors that filled in the gaps that perhaps.
No, because they were much more. So George was systematic. Now George mm-hmm. taught. 1 year he taught early modern intellectual mm. history, and the next year modern intellectual mm. history. So I took the whole series,
right.
And it was about, and he gave us a lot to read,
yes,
including Hegel.
Yeah.
But it was in the context of a big lecture,
right?
Where the courses at Brandeis were very small,
mm-hmm.
most of them,
mm-hmm.
and oriented towards reading original sources.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
With some secondary stuff mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. And so it was very good for me. It was a good year, but I realized I got to get back to Wisconsin, and mm-hmm. I realized what I'd had with George.
Mm-hmm.
So went back.
Mm-hmm.
And
then decided to do your dissertation.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, we went back to study with George. No question about anybody mm-hmm. else or anything. And that was really very interesting because George had a... in general, a way of opening things up and leaving you to do what you wanted to do and providing the context for doing. Now, the other model, and the only other people I practically knew there, with some exceptions, which I'll mention in a minute, but was trying to remember what his name was, but he taught 17th century England, and he taught a seminar year in, year out on 17th century England.
Never changing.
Never changing.
Yes.
And all of the students came in, and he assigned them, all right, you're doing Bishop so-and-so, that's your master's degree. Mm-hmm. So they would do a master's degree on an obscure bishop, and they knew all the sources, and they knew everything. Mm-hmm. And none of them ever amounted to anything. I mean, they got jobs, but there was no creativity, there was no openness. Mm-hmm. And that, and with George, you'd come in and just one time and you'd say, as I did, I want to do my dissertation on the French Libertin, early first half of the 17th century, and I'm interested in the fact that they all went to study in Italy, and they went and were in the households of bishops and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, I said, I'd like to study these Libertins in Italy, in their education, and so forth. He said, great topic, terrific, and so forth. But, you know, and then later on I'd come up with another topic, and it's a great topic. Now the key thing, when I came back, yes, I was now studying for prelims. And one of the people I studied with, apart from someone like Dan Toft, who was also studying for them, was Chris Johnson. Chris Johnson was studying with the French historian...
Was Gargan there in those years?
No, Gargan came. A lot of these people came after.
Okay.
While I was essentially gone, or came while I was finished or finishing. Mm-hmm. So the person I studied closely with was Domenico Sella.
Oh, yeah.
And Domenico Sella was very important because he filled in all the stuff that George did. And I did a lot of economic history with him, as I also did medieval history. We had to do a minor, and I did medieval history. In those days, Robert...
Reynolds still
Robert
there?
Reynolds was
he still
dying, but teaching. And I did some economic history with him and with one of his students. And it was great because we read all these contracts and sources and so forth. So I got a good feel for medieval economic history, and with Domenico, I did a reading course with Domenico Sella, and I have great fondness for Sella. He was very serious. We took thousands of notes.
Great guy.
He was really important, and a good pendant to George. And so as I was essentially doing early modern, he was also very crucial to all of his courses and so forth. But that's pretty much the history department as I knew it. It was George and Domenico Sella.
Amazing.
I started doing a course that George and what's his name? American historian did on Marx.
William Appleman.
William and Appleman. Right. But George said, I don't want you to take this sign up for it, but I want you to finish your master's thesis. Mm-hmm. I think that was the second semester or whatever. So when I came back, I was studying for prelims, and Chris Johnson and I read books together and discussed them in great detail. Chris eventually had a very good career at Wayne State.
Okay, and is he a Mossy student? That's
not no, one. He was a Hill student.
Okay,
that was it.
Henry Hill.
But he taught for George. He was one of his TAs.
Okay.
And he took all the courses from George as well. And he and I have edited. The latest thing we edited was co-edited. Let's see. I've done four books on kinship, which I've edited, co-edited. And he and I did the one on siblings together. And then he was part of the International Family book and part of the latest one that just came out on kinship and blood.
So we
reconnected, and we've worked very closely together. But as we are working through everything, we, and again, here was, George was really, as many people remarked, always like a decade ahead of everybody, or, and he was the one who discovered RES, for example, and I believe RES came to Wisconsin for a visit, and George, I can remember George.
Sponsored him.
Probably. Well, I don't know. I think he just dropped through or something, and I think it was RES, but I'm not sure. But in any event, he introduces us to RES and Thompson.
E.P. Thompson.
And I think we discovered Charles Tilly's book on our own. I'm not sure. But he was always, okay, so we were reading Tilly and, oh, and the person who was making a big splash at the time, Jack Hexter, Reappraisals in History. And between that kind of mixture, okay, so back up. And George's approach to cultural history was the thing we were all talking about and worrying about. And we were dissatisfied in many ways because he was leading us to a taste in popular literature, a sense of which ideas had effect. Not necessarily Hegel, but, you know, Marlitt, you know, some second-rate writer. Julius Langbein. When I think of the lectures he gave, and I bump into people now who are studying, say, Dinter's Sins Against the Blood or something like that. George gave whole lectures on these things.
It's amazing.
You know, and people are discovering Otto Dinter now. And I bought one, hit the book on an, at a antiquariat at a used bookstore recently, and was reading it. And George gave these great lectures on everything, Haeckel, and so forth. And all of these things which became texts that people are worrying about much later.
Yes, actually.
Well, that's it. So anyway, so but we were concerned with the issues of ideas having effect, ideas in politics. And he would sort of say, well, you know, thousands of people read this book, or everybody read this book, or there was a, you know, deep in the gymnasium or whatever. And that was kind of unsatisfactory.
In what way? Just
because it was seat of the pants. Sense of, we want to know how many, you know, numbers sometimes, so we wanted to know more, and I can't...
Numbers of people that had read
or editions and so forth, and he never did that sort of thing. He just said, everybody read it, whatever.
In that transcript of the seminar, he does, he tries to, because they kept pressuring him about that, and he claims that he did in fact have these numbers.
Yeah, well, no, he didn't have numbers, but he knew that there were big editions or many editions and so forth. But and he was right on, because he grew up in that culture, and several of the people who also grew up in Germany in that seminar, you know, a real gymnasium. You know, they didn't read any crap. And then they keep trying to say, but there's this crap literature and there's the great literature, and you have to differentiate. Well, the next generation, it's the 70s where, you know, come Germany and all these literature departments in Germany started reading the crap. And they start, and precisely what George was saying, the differentiation, the creation of the canon, and so forth, which becomes a big issue in the 70s and 80s and 90s and so forth.
I've been reading this biography of Himmler. He was reading all of that crap.
Right.
It's amazing.
Right.
He was reading those books that George mentions.
Yes, and that's, and that's in a sense, George had a real insight into a lot of these people, because he both... It's very interesting, and this comes, but he's he read it, he loved it. For example, when he went to South Africa, you know, he goes to the German areas and so forth, he read all the novels and knew precisely what he's looking for, and had a, you know, a great sense of this place because he already read all these novels as a kid, mm-hmm. and had them in his imagination, and he had a real sense for how these things work, but it wasn't replicable in the same way. Mm-hmm. So we are reading these new texts, and Chris and I, you know, I can remember sitting at lunch together and say, let's become social historians. Yes. What is it?
And we don't know what I think of.
And we began to catalog and think through what mm-hmm. social history could be. Mm-hmm. And it was around that time that I then realized that if I was going to be an early modernist, I had to have German, and I didn't have it first. Secondly, that I wanted to do social history. And the model was Tilly's Vendée study. So I still was thinking of social history in terms of an event. So I said to George, I want to do the German Peasant War. He said, great, bring me the book. No, don't bother me in between, which was also great. So he encouraged me. He helped me get fellowship. I went off to go to the archives. And, of course, he gave us no training in paleography or anything like that, right. As I don't either. As mm-hmm. I tell the students, you got to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And here are things you can mm-hmm. learn and so forth. And occasionally I'll sit with a student with who's been to the archives and has a transcript, and I'll teach him how to read it mm-hmm. and so forth. But, you know, it was a shock. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I couldn't read the stuff. Mm-hmm. It took a long while to get into it, but the great thing was that George just let me do it, and mm-hmm. And I had some of the things I had learned from Domenico Sella, how to study, mm-hmm. There were lots of questions that grew up in English economic history, mm-hmm. and in a sense I came with those questions to study, and I decided by myself I would study Upper Swabia because that's where the thing started.
So you found George's method or the direction that he was going in unsatisfactory as a model for you to mm-hmm. pursue, and yeah. you realized that.
But as it was also extraordinarily interesting. And then, you know, and in a sense, I rejected it for a long time. Came back mm-hmm. and was much more impressed. Mm-hmm. And I assigned the stuff to my students mm-hmm. all the time, and then I read, you know, and a lot of the stuff he produced later, and I mm-hmm. read it later, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and so forth. So I was at that transition period where he's going from that classical mm-hmm. early modern stuff, which he learned from McIlwain and mm-hmm. Lunt and so forth, to his ideological critique and interests. And so that book came out about, what, 62? The Roots of the Nazi Mind?
64.
Okay, 64. So as late in as I had him as an mm-hmm. undergraduate, right. as a graduate student. And so it's really a great deal of what that next generation, mm-hmm. Nye and Andy Rabenbach and all of those people, and mm-hmm. Gross, I think Gross came just as I was finishing, mm-hmm. All those people have a completely different George. Mm-hmm. The other thing was that George was going from being a kind of quasi-Protestant to becoming a Jew. Mm-hmm. And that was taking place. And mm-hmm. When he went off to take the chair in Jerusalem, which was much later, mm-hmm. See, all of that, he was still... He claims that he went to the Episcopal services every week in Harvard.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure he did,
and he probably did. Mm-hmm. But and then the Quaker schooling and mm-hmm. all that. So that mm-hmm. and his Reformation mm-hmm. little Reformation book, which was a runaway bestseller, mm-hmm. and so forth. So all of that, he was going from that to studying his youth, mm-hmm. The Nazi thing, the thing that he went through, and he's discovering more and more his Jewish.
He was a moving target.
Yes,
as a historian, wasn't
absolutely.
He?
So people like Andy know him completely differently from what I knew him. And he, as I say, his first seminar was in Calvinism, and then he did totalitarianism. Then he did the Radical Reformation. Then he went back and forth like that, and he really, when Bob Kingdon came, who came after I. Was when I was writing my dissertation. When he brought in Bob Kingdon, then he abandoned all of the Reformation to Kingdon. Up till then, he had all the Reformation scholars as well.
So he was, and in those years, I mean, there were about 10 years, and that's when the vast majority of his graduate students studies with him, because after about 72, he didn't take any more graduate students. And he had 38.
So he had a few from
Iowa, right?
Iowa. Then he had the generation of Sterling Fishman, Cy Drescher. And I got to know Cy very well. I got to know Sterling very well because Sterling came on the faculty while we were there. But he was also a little distanced. And I knew
reserved.
Him in Germany reserved. I knew him in Germany when we went there. And then I bumped into him from time to time, but Sterling and I became very close, as you know, but that was that early generation. The my generation, practically nobody finished. Then he had all that
the final burst, and
Nye, and a lot of people who worked closely with him, who essentially did their dissertations with him, but weren't formally, like. The guy at North Carolina who did study
Browning
was essentially, I think,
Georgia's
student.
Yeah, because Cale by that time was, well, let's not be critical, but, you know, I think George obviously was.
So there's a whole bunch of people like Joan Scott were very close.
Yes.
Chris Johnson was very influenced by him. I kind of jotted down a few people who were there at the time. Oh, Joan, talking with Joan a lot was also important at the time.
For you?
We weren't terribly close, but she was important. Andy I only knew later, of course. Bob Nye much later. Bob Soucy was important, but he went off to do his work at the time while we were studying for exams, so early on he was kind of influential. David Gross came just as I was leaving. Bob Poise, who went to Colorado, was a very strange person and very interesting, and we talked a lot, and he also studied for exams at the same time. Very quirky, very much more in George's ultimately in George's approach, and eventually very interested in psychology and psychoanalysis, and often and more in that using more formally Freud and so forth. Paula Chance was an undergraduate at the time when I was there, and became a graduate student. And Paul was interesting because I talked with him a lot about good writing, and then I lost touch with him. He did his dissertation with George, but it was younger. And of course, then Paul Brynäs, but Brynäs was an undergraduate.
He came back to
And I only got to know Paul much, much, much later, and not very well, but just and so forth.
And Steve, did you know Steve Asheim?
No, Asheim, of course, came well after I was gone. And I only know him from afar, and I've met him a couple of times. Extraordinarily impressive mind. And I think in some ways one of George's best students, but fully blown before he came. And also with a great presence,
charisma. He has that mossy charisma as a teacher.
And so And when we, after George died, and we did that book,
What History Tells.
Yeah. You know, almost all of the people there were, came later.
It's true.
I think Cy might have been there.
You and Cy, I think, were the two from the earlier period. Yeah.
Right. But then Cy and I didn't overlap. And
but for George's 80th, there were some people there from your period.
That's right.
Yeah, that's Grendler and some other ones.
Well, Grendler, right, he came, and Susie came.
Right.
Grendler and Susie were a year or two ahead of me. And then there was a guy, big Irish guy, huge guy, who sort of disappeared, but was one of Mossy's, same generation as Grendler. He and Grendler were very impressive figures in the seminar. I can't remember his name, but he went off to...
Not Thayer.
No, Thayer is much older.
Oh, he's
See,
older.
Thayer is that generation of Cy and, and
oh,
people.
He's part of that
and he
generation.
May even have started in Iowa.
Okay.
With and Thayer, and Thayer was, and so, Soloway,
right.
Thayer was always very distant and critical of George.
And, he was, yeah.
And
he,
trying to get him to take part in this, in the...
I read those. Yeah, they were very, very critical of George.
Yeah.
He found George's methods highly frustrating.
Well, so Thayer... You know, so we couldn't get there to write.
And, right.
That was very, very frustrating. So there was that earlier bunch. And then, and then my generation, which mostly didn't work out. And then a real, but this new generation were all into the New Left politics. They were all into Frankfurt School. And George introduced them to a lot of that stuff.
He really introduced. That history of the Frankfurt School in the U.S., along with the fellow at Berkeley, Shorsky, was it?
Well, it might have been Shorsky, but probably, what's his name? No, no, the, who wrote about the Frankfurt School.
Well, not Martin Jay.
Yeah, Martin Jay.
Well, George introduced him to it.
Oh, he did.
Yeah, because Marty just gave the Mossy lectures at the Hebrew University.
Oh, really?
He said that.
Oh, that's interesting.
Because George... knew some of these figures, you know. And he also knew Scholem, of course, and these people.
That's right.
And
but this is all later. George didn't mention the Frankfurt School to any of us.
It was later that he's...
It's all later. So that whole influence. And then George gets interested in sexuality.
Right.
He gets interested in Jewish history.
Right.
And starts doing undergraduate seminars in these things. And that, he never mentioned Jewish history to us. So, and that was my great ultimate criticism when I started to then teach German history, which I only did much later when I came here. Actually, only after I got the chair. So when I came back the second time, George, the fact that I didn't know any Jewish history, I blamed on George. Because, and then I'm trying to figure out how to catch up all and put it into German history. But he was
he taught the first seminar, his first seminar on Jewish history, or his first course.
Right.
He had taught, I think, a seminar, of course, when he went to the Hebrew University, but in 1970.
Yeah.
And we have that on our website. But the audio isn't very good.
Oh.
All of the, I'm trying to get that in. Improved, but all of the summaries are there, and it's basically German Jewish history.
Yes.
It has very, and whenever it was about, you know, Eastern European, George brought someone in because he didn't know anything about it, you know.
And he was contemptuous of all
he
of
was,
that.
He was, really, you know,
it was a very funny, very funny time when George is lecturing on either the Baltic or the Balkans or whatever, and he was calling it the wrong. So the Balkans, he was talking about the Baltic. But the Baltic, he was talking about the Balkans. And some kid raised his hand and said, don't you mean the Baltic or something? He says, and his 500 students, he's very funny, he'd say, Baltic, schmaltic, they're just a bunch of short little people running around that nobody cares about.
Terrible. Yes, Georgian facts. He was very, very skeptical of about facts and history. Yes, oh, this was right. not one of his, yeah, right. his strengths, let's put it that
well,
way.
Well, it was funny, when he introduced R.E.S., he would work these things into his lectures, whatever he was reading. Mm. So he always had his five pages that he had in front of him, but then he would riff on stuff.
Right.
And so he starts talking about R.E.S., and he's talking about, you know, these non-differentiation of girls and boys until there was seven or eight, and so right. they all wore the same thing. They all wore, he said, he wanted to say smock, but he said they all wore a little schmuck. And the entire place burst into laughter. And then, of course, George is trying to figure out, what did I say to funny kids? He wants to milk it, you know?
Right.
And so he goes back over it again, and he says, and they wore a little schmuck, and they laugh again. So afterwards, he says to me, what are they laughing at? Because he didn't know any Yiddish. That was the other thing. See? And I said, yes, or schmuck, Hebrew. George. You said schmuck. He said, what do you mean? And I said, you know, it's Yiddish we're talking about. And I explain it to him, and his face falls. He says, how did they know that? and he says, how terrible that they know these things. And I said, it's just Yiddish, George. And
in Wisconsin.
Even I know. And
yeah, right.
But it was very, very, very funny. And,
well, that's
and,
hilarious.
And that had to do with his put-on accent. He would always refer to Milwaukee.
He did that on purpose.
Yeah,
Warsaw right, and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
yes.
Volky show. And,
yeah.
And so,
yeah, he had his own language, put it that way. Well, maybe we should go on and yeah, we can
okay,
come back to some, and we can talk about...
Okay, graduate school. Talked about why George, you know, directed my dissertation on the German
right.
Peasant War. But the one great moment, I wrote the manuscript. Oh, I did the research. Oh, and then I getting a job. George was crucial, of course, but his cousin Werner was the professor at the University of East Anglia.
Was absolute opposite of George.
Totally
history.
Totally opposite.
Yeah. Perhaps George would have been like that if he had gone to England. Who knows? But
the key thing is how they, what the kind of school they went to, and exactly what age they hit school.
Okay.
Because
okay.
here's Werner in an English school and is the quintessential outsider.
Mm-hmm.
George played with his outsider too.
That's true.
But he was and awkward and
mm-hmm.
And very straightforward and
mm-hmm.
and
German.
In German and,
yeah.
and never and these kids must have been merciless
mm-hmm.
with him.
Mm-hmm.
And
he was probably gay also.
That could also
yeah.
yes.
He
yes,
probably
yes,
was. Yeah.
Yes,
and
yes.
of course he had seen his father killed right in front of his eyes.
Oh,
his father was a politician and he was shot. And
oh, I
Werner
didn't know
was
that.
There. Yeah. This
oh,
was
I,
in
I didn't
yeah.
know that.
Mm-hmm. I think this also
so because he was a completely he was verkrampft and he was
yes.
just a completely different.
But a great historian in his own way from
yeah, I
I've
mean,
been
he,
told,
I mean,
of German Jewish history.
Yes, yeah, no, that came
mm-hmm.
later. He was
yeah.
writing a three-volume history of the Russian Revolution when I knew
okay.
him,
right.
and he sent it off, and von Lauer said it was a piece of crap, and he abandoned it.
Mm-hmm.
And he started off with a book on you know diplomatic history
mm-hmm.
And so forth, and then he started writing on
okay.
on completely and did a very fine job.
I interrupted
but
you. So
no, but
that
time
that
he was totally alienated and isolated at East
yeah.
Anglia, and
you,
but in any event, George
got you this a position.
George
there,
said George
okay.
said to his cousin, hire David, and I went and gave a miserable interview because I know what the hell I was doing, and Werner, you know, said, took me in. They hired me, and I had a great 4 years.
Mm.
There. It was swinging England,
mm-hmm.
went through
great.
68, and it was really interesting, great
mm-hmm.
teaching.
Mm-hmm.
It was seminar teaching,
mm-hmm.
though I essentially did George's seminars,
mm-hmm.
and I had to give three lectures a year, you know, it was essentially a seminar situation, not tutorials,
mm-hmm.
So I easily slid into it. A lot of the English faculty who had been raised on tutorials at Cambridge and Oxford couldn't figure out how to run seminars,
mm.
and they had great problems. And sometimes they broke up their seminars into tutorials and so forth. But I was very influenced there by some anthropologists. And that's when I got... So I had written this stuff. Oh, let me come back to the point about George. I wrote... I did the research, and then the first year, and maybe even the second year, I figured out I had to learn how to do statistics. I had to learn how to think about this material. And it was this time that Lou Ellery's great book on Languedoc came out, and that was very influential. I began to read the French Annales School a lot. I began to read, issues of population change and all those kind of things, which were all new and new to me, and trying to figure out how to utilize them and think about them for the background to the German Peasant War. And then I was also using English economic historical ideas of changes in rent, changes in land tenure, and that sort of thing. And then I wrote it up, and George came to London, and I went down and handed him the dissertation. I went to the British Museum and working in the library, and met him there, handed it to him. By the end of the day, he'd read the first half and gave it to me. By noon the next day, he'd read the rest of it with his comments. Amazing. Now, his comments were, they were in some ways useful, some ways frustrating, and he just said, you know, finish going through the revisions, which I did, and then he accepted it. And it was that sense of immediately dealing with graduate student work. He always did that, no matter what he was doing. He turned graduate student work around immediately,
which is so helpful, to say the least, and not currently
absolutely
the way
and that has
done.
Always been my model.
That's great.
I
That's
always really turn graduate student work right around, except as I'm getting older, it's more difficult. but I always do that, and that his sense of professionalism. I have to give students lectures on professionalism. His example as a professional simply taught us all a great deal about professionalism. And because we, you know, to one level you think, you know, because he didn't care about facts so much, and his and he's always bullshitting and so forth around you, so forth. You have this sense. You know, he's very Prussian. Very organized.
Oh, yes. Very disciplined.
Very disciplined.
Oh, indeed.
And that you learn with time and with his interaction with you, because he always took your work seriously. He always critiqued it. He didn't praise you, no patting on the head, but full support. And that you learned, that the support was there. And so forth. So his...
That he valued you and your work.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes, right.
And so so he turned it right around. I did it right away. And then I couldn't afford... We were in miserable pay in England, and I couldn't afford for a whole year to come to Madison to get... You know, in those days we had a... have a committee.
An exam. Who was on the committee?
Now, there the committee was people I hadn't worked with. Sella was on it. But,
okay.
Kingdon.
Okay.
And Herlihy.
Oh, sure.
And Herlihy didn't read it. He kind of thumbed it through and told me that my table should have, you should have a little thing under that saying what the table was. Kingdon read it, thought, liked it a lot. Sella read it, of course, he was the one that gave the challenging question. George asked the wrong question at the beginning. He said, "This is a very innovative dissertation. Could you discuss your innovation?" And, you know, I'm seat of the pants learning how to do this, reading, and I didn't have an, I couldn't at that point stand back and talk you in general. And I actually context. Learned how to do that from that very question. but we were all sicker in hell. We all had the flu. And I flew all the way from England, and the whole thing lasted 45 minutes. But George was extraordinarily supportive. Mm-hmm. Got me the job. Mm-hmm. We had a problem later,
you and George.
Yeah, because okay. George would only write one. A letter for one person per job. So
in
those days, that may have changed later, but in those days and much later. So when I taught it, I came from East Anglia to Pittsburgh, and then I got an offer to go for a year on my sabbatical to the Max Planck Institute for history in
right.
Göttingen. Mm-hmm. And misunderstanding what a sabbatical was, I stayed for 7 years.
but you never must not have gone back.
Anyway, so when I was finished and had to come back and get my kids back into schools and so forth, I applied for two jobs, Iowa. And there were the only two jobs, and here. Mm-hmm. Okay. And George had already written for Andy, and he wouldn't write a letter.
For here?
For here.
Okay.
And Peter Ryle, who was chairing the committee, wrote to me and said, you've got to have a letter from Mossy. So I called George and said, you've got to write me a letter. And so there was a great deal of tension between us at that point.
Mm-hmm. Did he finally write one? Or?
Yeah, he did. Okay. But he wanted Andy to have the job. Mm-hmm. And Andy interviewed, and I interviewed, mm-hmm. and a woman named Nuschel, who went to Duke. Mm-hmm. And I got the job. I mean, I think Andy's a great historian and probably deserved it more than I. Mm-hmm. But I got the job partly because it was an early modern. They wanted an early modern.
Right.
And then I stayed here for 5 years, and I hated Los Angeles, and didn't quite know what I had, and I was beginning to develop a seminar situation like George's, which was always my model for teaching, and I never was able to deal with students one-on-one properly. I don't like that, you know. Mm-hmm. I really like the seminar situation, and that's what I encourage. I develop. We have a quarter system here, and so I invented the two-quarter research seminar. The first quarter was that introduction into a topic, and the second quarter they give papers. Mm-hmm. And so it's exactly George's seminar. Mm-hmm. And when I first came, all of the seminars were monopolized by two older faculty members, and a bunch of us got together and restructured the nature of the graduate education. And I started doing, and like George, I try to create big structures. And one of the things that had struck me when I came back was how different the German discourse about selfhood and the American discourse about selfhood was. So the first seminar I gave was on the history of individualism. Mm-hmm. And it's in that seminar that I put in history of the body, history of memory, history of identity, subjectivity, conscience, sexuality, none of which had taken off yet. Mm-hmm. And gender was the only one that was beginning. And all of these became whole subjects and vast literature in the next bunch of years. Hi, Sam.
Oh, hey, I'm sorry.
Yep. And I then the next seminar I gave was on the history of the body. And then I got a call from Cornell, and I interested, and then I thought, yeah, this would be great, great teaching. And I went off to Cornell and regretted it the moment I got there. It was in the middle of freaking nowhere, and all of the faculty were there for, had come in the 60s, and the hates and loves were all set, and and I couldn't, it took me a while, it took me 5 years, and I came back to the chair here.
And George used to come out there.
Yeah, George came for you, and that was part of, I was part of the group that brought George. An interesting, I think he came for 2 or 3 years. That was the idea, yeah.
And there was a whole, then he was A.D. White, you know, but you had left by then, I think. He was A.D. White professor there for 4 years, and he had a couple years when he passed away. Still left.
Yeah, well, that was the thing. Oh, that was always part of bringing him for that.
Okay, yeah. He went, I think he for 4 years he came out.
And Le Copper played a role and so forth. Right. It was a big fight because when no one knows quite what happened, but Najami claims that George, I can't remember, they made some insult about
Sand?
Middle East being a hellhole or something like that.
Right.
And Najami,
sand jockeys or something like that.
Whatever. Yeah. And then Najami fought bitterly not to allow George to come.
Jamie, who's that?
Ned Jamie is.
Oh,
the
Ned
name.
Jamie. Oh, sure. Yeah. Okay.
And it's a Renaissance scholar. Right. And Le Capra and I and several others fought to have George. And, and then our question was, I was talking with Joan Scott, and the two of us were laughing about it all. And she said, well, he probably did say that. And I said, I know he probably did say it.
Of course he did. course he did.
And so forth. So it was, but he was very successful. Everybody liked him at Cornell.
And then you ended up coming back here.
And then I came back here, but then there was a chair in German history that Wehler had turned down.
Okay.
And they were looking for somebody who would actually come. So I was able to come back. And then I became a German historian. I taught courses in European history. I taught, as I say, these big seminars in which I always had four or five books first in anthropology, and then we would read historical works on let's say the history of individualism in some way with student reports. And that first group was a really good group of graduate students, terrific group. Ann Goldberg, who's at who just got a prize for her second book, was at UC Riverside. Matt Matsuda, who's at Rutgers, very inventive and very interesting historian.
And these are your doctoral students?
So Matt wrote on, you asked me in somewhere here, how many graduate students I've had? 17.
17?
And I'm on 10... I'm chairing 10 committees at the moment, so I may eventually.
If you keep going, you may,
But I was also.
You're still really enjoying it and stimulated
I was going over some, and then I was very close and worked very closely with 11 students who eventually did their PhD. That is, I did. A dissertation reading group at home,
Like George used
for many
to do.
Years. And so I had a lot of students who came who weren't, I wasn't chairing. And one of the most brilliant, and I think one of the best students we ever had, was Claudia Verhoeven, who now is at Cornell and teaches Russian history. But she was first going to do a dissertation with me on German Peace Museum, and then she decided to work on the first attempt to assassinate Alexander II, and did a brilliant book that's published by Cornell, and then she started off at George Mason and went to Cornell. She's now at Cornell, and she's quite brilliant. And I worked with several others, a guy named Robert Batchelor, who does very inventive and very obscure global history stuff. I mean, he wrote an article in a book I edited on space and self, in which he took a Japanese character that deals with space, and it's like a kind of almost like a riffing on this. He's in England here, he's in Japan there, he's in China here. It's just moving. Anyway, Bob actually was did his senior honors thesis under me at Cornell. Then he came here, and by the time I came back, the professor he's working with, John Brewer, had left, and I think technically he I was the chair in the end for him. I may not have, but I think so. But I thought through. So Bob Batchelor, I think, is really very interesting. I wrote down a number of them. And the interesting thing is, most of my students, I've had early modern and modern. Mm-hmm. I've had French and German. Mm-hmm. So when Lynn Hunt came, then I didn't get any more French historians, and so forth. But Jared Poley worked on essentially Weimar Republic stuff. Very intellectual history, very, very much like George's work, but self-invented. And then I've had two really good early modernists working in German history, Ben Marschke and Jared Poley, who are extraordinarily active and played a big role, as has Jared Poley in the German Studies Association. They run the program, they're on the general committees. They are very good and very inventive young historians. Britta McEwen did her dissertation on sexual knowledge in Red Vienna, the whole development of sexual advice centers and so forth and so on. And then one of my most successive was John Mangum, who is now running the San Francisco Philharmonic, but for a while was vice president of the New York Philharmonic. He wrote his dissertation on the building and development of the opera in Opera House in Berlin. Very inventive, very nice. And then one student I worked closely with is Ritika Prasad, who worked on railroad construction and the meaning of the railroad in India. A cultural historian who pushed in the direction of social history. Another very fine historian that I worked closely with was Bill Clark, who wrote a book on the development of the German university and the seminar, and it's been translated into about 10 languages, and a very important book. And one who's going to develop and become very famous is Teresa Barnett, who actually ended up, she came to all my seminars, she's older, she had already abandoned a PhD in literature, but she was like this vice director of the oral history program here. She eventually became director. She did her PhD in history, in American history, looking at the whole development of artifact in 19th century America.
That's great.
And she's really smart, and she's running that. And her dissertation has been rewritten and coming up with Chicago. So there's been some really smart and interesting
You know,
practices.
David, it seems that in many ways, with huge exceptions, you've replicated George's career in the sense that your focus is
model.
And
it became more German than I expected. But I've no disciples. Nobody does what I do.
But, and you know, this is typical of George, too, in that sense, absolutely. That there isn't this kind of theoretical approach that you can bounce off of and play with. And yet, in another way, when you think of, you know, your students and George's students and the tremendous influence they've had in various universities in Europe, in the U.S., in Israel, you know, it's a... it's not a school,
Where's my phone?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's coming. That's my phone.
Oh, that's
I
your
think.
Phone.
Yeah, we'll just. But also your peripatetic career and the fact that you still. Yeah, I mean that you still, you know, spend large amounts of time on the road and away and sabbatical, that you're still very passionate about your work. They still love teaching, that this is more a calling than a job. I mean, there's perhaps there isn't, a school, but there's maybe...
That influence was... There were several structural influences. The range, early modern and modern.
Right.
And now, when I moved to social history and I first tried to teach social history, I was never able to synthesize in the way that George had synthesized intellectual history. So I never was successful at quite doing that and keeping a good social history from early modern to modern. And I was always moving around social history, cultural history, intellectual history.
Yeah.
So that, so one of my books is, well, The chief thing I sat down took 30 years to do was this village study, hardcore social history.
Right.
But as I was doing it, I did Power in the Blood, which is much more discourse and so forth. Now, the key difference is I did this village study, which I did family reconstitution and put in all of the data about, every court appearance, inventories, land sales, and so forth. Now, what George did, which was really different and intellectually, is he's reading all these texts. And so each book builds on this bunch of texts.
Right.
And every time he has to give a lecture, he can spontaneously talk about Fichte or whatever he wants to do and so forth. Where I, put together a little biography of Hans Hensler, while I could write these two thick volumes on the village, and perhaps there was another volume to be written, I don't have this huge literature behind me, and most of what I have behind me is what I read in graduate school. No, I've read a lot since then, and I read a lot of anthropology, and for a number of years I only read anthropology until it got too self-reflective and reflexive and so forth. But I read a lot of monographs, read a lot of anthropology. I did do year with Jack Goody in Cambridge studying anthropology systematically. And so forth, and always for a long time saw myself much an anthropologist as a historian. Now, as I'm coming back, I still see myself as a social historian, and so forth. The last seminar I gave was on the epistemological foundations of social history, trying to figure out what it is that I've been doing all these years, constituted a group with an Israeli scholar, Gadi Al-Ghazi, who was chair of the Tel Aviv History Department, was a medievalist, and then scholar at Zurich, Simon Teuscher, who I've edited books with, the three of us are putting together a compact group of 12 or 13 people to meet regularly and discuss social history. Now, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. But the book I'm doing now, I've been working for many years on without much success so far, is on the history of incest discourse from 1600 to now in Europe and America. And it's very complex and trying to figure it all out. But sometimes I'm writing up a whole bunch of texts, and I find myself writing like George. And it's very unsatisfactory because I don't do it as well. And but it's reading through this, that, or the other writer. Like I sat down one of the periods I'm dealing with is the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, where throughout the West, but particularly in Germany, there's an enormous amount of stuff written about mother and motherhood, and mother is highly sexualized. And so I read every book in the Staatsbibliothek in Berlin with the word Weib or female in the title. And then I got a massive amount of material, and then I begin to write it through. I'm writing more like George, and what I'm trying to do is nail down, and this is then back to that original problem, nail down this discourse in social relations, and trying to figure out how what the context is, and the context really is how families are structured, how bourgeois society is structured, and why mother and motherhood is such a topic. So it's trying to get that other level of dimension without doing a simple structure and superstructure thing or all the other models. But I think of culture and society as indissoluble, and trying to figure out how they're related is very complex and so forth. But it's back to the original problematic that I found in George's work and in his seminars, and it's very difficult. And but again, as I take one after the other of these women and men who are writing, and I was interested in, as George is, in both the popular and the scientific, and I want to see them as a continuum, not as a some cell biologist. I want to see them as a Pfadfinder, you know, as a kid who grows up and he's a cell biologist, but all that crap is in him, and and his relationship and thinking about gender and so forth and so forth. So a cell biologist, and then I want to look at a popular novelist and try to treat and think of European society in this period as an anthropologist would look at it. And I think George's eye was very much an anthropologist's eye before the fact. And that perhaps when I reflect on it, that plays a big role in how I think about things and how I try to do it. But writing it up the first time is not satisfactory. And I've got to find a different way of writing it. But George had a good way of weaving his way in and making a judicious comment about how this text fits, and then go on and so forth. So it's that huge set of things that he'd read that he always can call on. And frequently, it's a associative. He has this associative way, and I can't. I'm not skilled enough to pull that off.
Very few historians are allowed to pull that off right. or are satisfied with it. But George, right. because he had both the reputation, but also his style right. of writing right. was expected, you know. Right. He was allowed to do that in right. a way, and he was so good at it, as you said, right. you know.
Right. So, yeah. so, yeah. but it was it's also the problematic that we were. Let's see. Let me see if I can pick up on some of the questions you asked.
Well,
here.
Yeah.
Do constitute a school or an approach to history? I think the cohesiveness of that next generation was much mm. greater.
Yes.
I. Interrelate with the ones that I see often with, of course, Tsai and Drescher and with Andy Rabenbach and so forth. Those are the ones I see most often. Andy used to get together with us at the HA for
yes, right, month. Yes.
But when I listened to Andy, it's a different George.
It's amazing.
And Tsai and I probably a little bit more. But I was in, and I pick up on a lot of things about George, George's Protestant, George's, and so forth, which other people wouldn't have unless they were attuned to what he knew and what he could talk about and so forth. Let's see. But, on the other hand, we did see ourselves almost as a bunt, as a bunch of men, young men, with the leader. And when he talked about all his folkish stuff about leadership and so forth, so we were all, you know, enthralled by it all. And we loved the fact that we were a special group because we thought we were the most exciting, the best group in at Wisconsin. And we kind of hung around together. We didn't know, at least I didn't know a lot of people outside, except when we were studying for exams, then people like Chris Johnson and so forth. And so, you know, I did not keep a close relationship with George's students over right. the years, except when I come back to, and again, with Tsai, Tsai was, Tsai was very important. You asked a few things about living, we'll have to break off some. But
yeah,
I get something to eat.
But yeah, maybe we can. Yeah, I just want to ask you a bit more about you know George's legacy and reputation before
right.
we. You know, it's George always said, everything is politics.
Yes.
Everything
That's
is political.
That's another great insight.
Yes,
and I have.
And then yeah. Foucault came along. Yeah. Everything is power. 10 years, 12 years. Which is essentially the same thing.
It's similar, but
yeah.
but Mossi has a greater feel for social reality. I mean, Foucault is very abstract.
Yes,
and, I mean, Foucault, you know, dug out stuff about
yes.
the prison, about the psychiatric
yes.
profession, and
but
so
a real disdain for facts, also.
Yeah, also
very much so. Yes.
Yeah, and that's
even worse because
yeah.
he extrapolated
yeah.
in a much more.
Right.
Ambitious,
well,
yeah.
the thing about Foucault and the thing about Bourdieu and so forth is they came up out of the lycée.
Mm-hmm.
They all did explication de texte. The whole set of people read exactly the same things, exactly the same hour every day.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Foucault takes and turns something around and twists it, it's out of that precise
mm-hmm.
Set of texts which they all read, Pascal, Descartes,
mm-hmm.
and so Proust,
mm-hmm.
and so forth
mm-hmm.
and so on. And he's playing with that. And in a sense, it's a series of texts.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, George has got a different set of texts, but he's playing with that set
mm-hmm.
of texts.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is that George is decentered.
Yeah.
He moves from Germany to here.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody here has those texts.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
it would be a little bit like Marcuse. Marcuse is
mm-hmm.
bringing the gymnasium, and nobody
mm-hmm.
has that set of
mm-hmm.
texts or that
mm-hmm.
range. And the same thing, Foucault is often misunderstood in the United States because he's working through a tradition which he doesn't necessarily always mention.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much that I had graduate students who were Foucauldians,
mm-hmm.
but they don't know Descartes, mm-hmm. they don't know mm-hmm. Pascal, they don't know mm-hmm. they don't know the text, mm-hmm. and they mm-hmm. think they know
Foucault,
but mm-hmm. they don't know what he's talking about.
Well, and I think the basis of George's work was a moral and ethical.
Absolutely.
And he also was a great human being.
Yes.
And that's very different.
No, it's the moral commitment,
mm-hmm.
the understanding of politics at a kind of visceral level and an everyday level.
Yes. Right.
That has remained, mm-hmm. and that has influenced how I think about things a lot, and regrets, because for example, when I started doing the kinship study,
mm-hmm.
I was reading around in development studies and the idea that the nuclear family was the product of Western civilization, and without the nuclear family, you can't have development.
Right.
And so Ford money and all these big people in the 60s and 70s were pouring money into talking people into developing the nuclear family and getting rid of kinship.
Mm-hmm.
So my simple question was, a very simple one, is it true, the history of the family as the development of the nuclear family? Mm-hmm. And if once in the past Europe had kinship and then it developed the nuclear family, how could we model and talk about kinship? And that was the influence of these anthropologists at East Anglia on me. And then, to solve the problem, I entered into looking at one small little place to see if you could really look at kinship. It took me 30 years to do. Mm-hmm. Simple question, and so forth. And the push was a political, ethical issue, but solving it and dealing with it was a different kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So teaching is different. Teaching allows me to open up issues about selfhood,
mm-hmm.
history of the self, how to think about it, mm-hmm. how to critique, mm-hmm. and so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And that ethical idea remains, but I can't, like George integrated the two, his mm-hmm. research and mm-hmm. his teaching, and
mm-hmm.
I've split it. I can't do that
mm-hmm.
because I chose the social historical route and the route of, I mean, I thought it was going to take me 7 or 8 years to do the Neckehausen
mm-hmm.
studies,
mm-hmm.
and it really took exactly 30 years, and so, and once I was in it, I couldn't abandon it. So I kind of was schizophrenic in both the teaching and the research, and in a sense, the kind of thing I'm doing now is much more integrated.
Mm-hmm.
But it still is all about social relations and how they're structured, mm-hmm. and what the implications of certain forms of social mm-hmm. interaction are.
Well, we probably, given it's 12:30, and I know you have an appointment at 1.
Yeah, I can run and get something to eat.
Yes, we probably should wrap it up.
Okay, let me tell you how to get to my house.
Okay, yes.
Okay.
Let me turn this off, though. Thank you so much. That's one.